This project has been going for a little bit less than a year, and it started as a little curiosity, but then it sort of meandered into all sorts of rabbit holes. And currently it's been supported by three different organizations. It's the Ethereum Foundation in form of grants, and also by Infura, doing contracts with me and Interchain Foundation as well. You probably know about Interchain Foundation via the Cosmos product. So let's start. So I'm going to skip all the slides that I had before because you've probably seen them. So we start right from the meat about what is the difference between the Geth and TurboGeth. And so on the slide, you could see on the left-hand side, you could see like the in Ethereum, the state of accounts and the contracts and their storage is modeled as the Patricia tree, which is essentially a Radix tree of the Radix 16 with some refinements to be able to get rid of some waste of space. And when you model it like that and you want to persist it in a database, the persistence looks like on the right-hand side, which is the key of the... So it basically the whole structure, every node in this Patricia tree is split in is one record in a database. And for that record, the key is the hash of the serialization of this node, and the value is the serialization itself. What it allows us to do is let's pretend that we do not have that pink node in the top, like the diamond pink node, and instead we simply have a hash, which you could see that is a little dark rectangle. So what we could do is that we could take that hash and then use it as the key in the database and look up the serialization of that pink node and reconstruct it and then plug it into the tree. So that's how basically pretty much all the clients do that, as far as I know. And so the problem that so that when I first saw it actually I was a bit surprised because for me it wouldn't be how I would do it, and that's why I actually started on this process, because whenever I see something which doesn't look like I expected, this is where you. So I didn't expect to see that, but probably it was very natural for other people. So the main problem here that I saw is that, let's say that when you only have a root and nothing else in the memory, and then you want to fetch, let's say, element V5, which is the purple diamond in the, on the bottom right, you actually have to do 1, 2, 3 lookups to the database. And the reason for that is because in order to retrieve that diamond, you have to first retrieve the element before that because it contains its hash. So and vice versa. So you have to do 3 sequential lookups to the database. You cannot parallelize them because there's a data dependency there. So that gave me the idea of not doing that. So basically, you see in the red matters, depth should not matter. It means that how can we do that without doing 3 lookups or 5 lookups or 7 lookups or whatever? I think at the moment, on average, it will be 8 or 9 lookups if you don't go from the root. So what I tried to do is that, okay, let's just put them in a database as I would expect it to be. Like, you got a key, which is the actual key of the value that you want to store, and the value is the actual value that you want to store. And if it's a historical value, then we're gonna append some kind of block number encoded in some way to the key, just for simplicity. And the main problem here is that how are we going to compute the numerical hash of that? And I think initially when the first clients have been produced, the assumption was that, oh, that's going to be super expensive to actually have this flat representation and then to rebuild the whole tree. And then everybody decided to go, okay, let's do Patricia tree in a database. But then I said, well, why not? Let's try. And then I tried that, and actually it turned out that you can do things in a lot of cases much faster if you simply rebuild the hash tree on the fly, and you use some caching and stuff like this. So the way it looks like, imagine that we need to get to this pink diamond now. With the pink diamond, we just simply fetch it. But actually, let's say that we want to compute the hash of that the oval that dash thing. So in this case, we do a range query, which will fetch us all the keys and values which starts with 1, which is the actually might be the picture might be wrong. But anyway, so you probably get the idea. So we get the range of keys and values, and then we apply our Merkleization to them, and we get the hash. It only kind of works for the current state, if you want to compute the Merkle hashes of the current state. But for historical state, it's a kind of a lot of work, because you don't usually store the historical state in your cache. But it works reasonably well for the RPC queries that are tested. So let's go. So as I mentioned, that Infura has been supporting this project for some time. And one of the things we did is that instead of me only running the TurboGuest on my machines or some cloud machines, they tried to run it out of the source code. And this is what happened. And I was kind of pleasantly surprised, because I must have been running it on really bad machines before. So now I usually got 2 weeks to sync it, but this was actually synced in about 6.5 days. Yeah, 6.5 days. And the pretty recent block, and it's archive node actually, so it has a full unrolled history, and it only was what 250 something gigabytes, which was cool, because it's probably six times less than you would normally get. And just as an interesting thing, that the memory profile. So what you can see here is that the yellow oscillating bit is that. It's obviously Go, it has a garbage collection, and that's why it's oscillating so much. It's basically allocated heap, which goes into about 13 gig maximum. And you can see the spike about the spam attacks, where it was a big load. And the green bit is the number of nodes. So what TurboGuest does, actually, one of the things it does differently as well, is that you can limit number of nodes that you can, of the tree you can store in the cache. And that might allow you. So my hope was that you can use that to calibrate the heap space, but you know, I think it might still be constantly increasing. So now look at these graph. So what you can see is this is the recent, well, quite recent, maybe 1 month old graph, and this is where the cost of storage comes from. Most of it is now block bodies, which is essentially this is all the blocks combined for like 6 million blocks. And then the second biggest structure is called the block. This is like a gray one, block number to changed keys. This is the structure which is specific to TurboGuest, and it allows it to know which accounts and which storage indices changed at which block. And why do we need this is because it allows us to do to rewind the state quickly. So in a situation where, let's say that we've been like syncing to the main chain, and then we suddenly see rework of like four blocks. So what the TurboGuest does, it actually looks at this mapping and figures out which keys changed in these four blocks, then picks up the values which were before these four blocks, and then unwinds the tree in a hash, and then computes a new hash, and then reapplies the state on the fork, on the Delta fork. And so what you do not see here is the receipts. You can have them there. They would take about 70 to 80 gigabytes of all receipts from the beginning. And I will show you later why you want to do that. The interesting bit to note is that lots of people are confused about the size of the state in Ethereum. And the reason why they're confused is because different clients store the state differently. Like for example, Go Ethereum, current state representation in Go Ethereum will probably like 80 gigabytes, 90 gigabytes. In TurboGuest, it's probably going to be about 12 gigabytes. I don't know how it's going to be in parity, but it's different clients store it differently. And sometimes people confuse the current state with the like total historical state, with the pruned historical state. That's why it's, but what you can see from this picture, on the very top, you can see accounts, which is 3.89 gigabytes. This is the account without any storage items. It's just simply balances, nonces, hashes of the storage roots, and the code hashes. And the whole, no, it's not the whole history, it's the current accounts. So the history of accounts, you can see on the left, on the yellow bit, so 44 gigabytes. Then the storage of the contracts, the current state is, what, 10 gigabytes? You can see it somewhere down the middle, the purple, violet bit. And then you can see the history of it's about 26 gigabytes. So you can see that the current state is still kind of about 12 gigabytes probably. Now, so this is where I'm going to say about receipts, because I haven't tested all entire set of RPCs. And again, these numbers are very rough. I didn't do scientific studies on this, but this is what I just saw after very quick running. I run both archive geth and turbo geth on the same machine, and obviously there would be lots of noise, but I could see through this noise that generally the things are going faster, except for the receipts. And the reason for that is because I chose to prune the receipts from the database, and instead I just recompute them. So when somebody asks me for a receipt, I just go to the state where that was at that block, and after that transaction, I just re-execute the transaction, produce the receipt, return them. It turns out to be slower. Actually, this might be not 10 times, maybe a bit more slower. But somebody told me that maybe it just needs to be a flag, because some people, the only thing they do is actually querying receipts. So for those people, they might be able to, might want to pay 70 gigs for speed of that RPC. So now, the other thing I did quite recently in TurboGeth is that I have prepared it for the pruning, but I haven't implemented pruning yet. But I made sure that the pruning can be done pretty trivially. And so the idea here is that instead of, so what you could see in this diagram, so every bubble, every little circle is actually a record in a database. And so the arrows, like the thick arrows, they represent that each of these circles is basically a representation of the state for that period of time. So let's say that the green circle on the right is the current state. It means that the current state has been for that, like if you look at the top one, for the last, let's say, 7 blocks or 8 blocks, I don't see it exactly, this was the current state. And it hasn't been changed for 7 or 8 blocks, right? And before that, there was this yellow bit, which was since we know, and so on. So the red bit is where something gets deleted. For example, the account gets deleted, then I mark it as a red. We put it as a record as well. And also that you could see that the blank blue one, this is where something just first been created and there was nothing in bit before. So now what we can do is that, what I call it reverse diffs instead of forward diffs. And what it allows you to do is this. So if you basically chop off the left bit, then you can just keep running your node, because you still have everything is still consistent. So you can still query the state at any point that you have a history for. If you try to do it with the forward diffs, that would be difficult. Because you would have to, when you chop this up, you would have to rebuild the current state at the point of the chop. Because everything is relative to the previous, some sort of previous snapshot. So, as I said, I haven't implemented yet, but it's trivial. Now, light clients, I mean, here I actually mean light server, and at the moment it's not implemented, and the reason for that is because I simply don't store any hashes in the database, and I kind of do, but not much, only for the current state. So what the light clients actually need, you can see on the right-hand side all the ticks that the LES2 protocol needs all this support of all these things. And the ones that I currently cannot provide is these, the ones which I pointed with the red arrows, which is node data and proofs, right? So node data will be very difficult in any way, because it's specific to, it turns out to be specific to the way that current clients store the state, and it will be very difficult for me to implement that, because it's actually, you cannot come up with any hash in the history or in the current state, which I have no idea which block it is from, and you're supposed to give me, I'm supposed to give you the node for that, and I don't have idea where to look for it in my database, because my database is structured by the blocks. The get proof is easier for me, because it at least it tells me at which block and at which account to look for, so I can actually find it. So it's easier to implement that, and maybe I know that the light clients can ask for proofs not for the current state but for some delayed state, but it could be done. And then there's another problem which I encountered recently. I call it create to revival problem. And it's also actually, this is also to inform people about something which is coming up in Constantinople. It is not in the mainnet yet, by the way. Don't get scared. It's the, so create to opcode essentially is introduced to allow efficient counterfactual instantiation. And the way it does it, is that if you look at the formula of the address computation, it includes address, which is basically the creator of this contract, salt, which could be chosen at will, and then init code, which is something which will be executed to generate the actual deployed code. So that means that you can, in theory and in practice, recreate the contracts after they've been self-destructed. So in this diagram, the big circles is the contract, and the small circles is the storage items of the contract. And you can see that how contract was created and storage has been modified, blah, blah, blah. And then it got to the point where it got self-destructed and you got all these red things. And then later on, like three blocks later, it's been recreated using create2 with the same code or with a different code, but with the same init code. And then after that, you're supposed to, so it's assumed that now at this point the storage is cleared and balance is cleared. So this is completely empty contract. And now you can start again. So the problem for TurboGet is that because it doesn't store the state as a tree, but rather in this relational way, it has to either insert all these red bubbles into the database, which could be in millions, potentially, at the point of self-destruction, or it has to apply much more nuanced way when you actually fetch the contract items. So alternative would be to, like, whenever anybody asks me for the contract storage, I would have to also check whether the contract has been self-destructed in the past and when it was the last time. So it's more searching. I can implement it, but it's kind of a bit hassle. Now, so this is highly experimental. This is something that I came up with when I was thinking about all these problems that with the Light clients and with the create2, and at the same time I was working with the Ethermint team, and they basically we did some tests with the loading Ethereum transaction at Ethermint, and it turns out to be a bit slow. So I said we need to get faster with that, and so the idea is to actually create a specialized database that would allow these few desirable things. And I will explain why they might be good. It's still very experimental, so it turned out to be in a different way. So although I did some proof of concept on this, I will tell you roughly what the results were. So let's get into the details of that. So as you know, again, as I told you before, is about the Ethereum currently uses Patricia tree for miracleization, but also before inserting anything in the Patricia tree, it also applies the hash function to the key. So the keys are not just inserted as they are. And this is because back in 2000, whenever, 15, I think, when there was a security audit of Ethereum, something pointed out by Andrew Miller that you could actually create a very, very long branches in that tree. But attacker could do that, and I basically introduced some bad things. So as a mitigation, it has been suggested to hash all the keys before inserting them into the Patricia tree. And the idea is that it would kind of balance them out. It still doesn't completely solve the problem, but we're not going to touch it right now. So for the Ethereum 2.0, for example, there's also suggestion of a sparse Merkle tree, which is essentially also radix tree, but with a different radix. Instead of radix 16, they use radix 2. But the idea is very similar. And for the same exact reason, the keys will have to be hashed. And the reason I don't like the hash keys is firstly because I believe that the problem pointed out in security audit has not been completely resolved, and it will keep persisting if we stick with the sparse Merkle trees. And also, you also have to keep pre-images, so to be able to iterate through the state. And the pre-images are not really heavy at the moment, but I just chopped the bit out of the diagram, it's about 15 gigs. So what I've been experimenting with, and of course it's been inspired by the fact that Ethermint uses the AVO trees, looking at the balancing trees, and the main objection to balancing trees was that the order of insertion and deletion actually matters. And I've been looking at not only AVO trees but also the weight balance tree. It's actually really little known about them, but these are the structures which are really good for functional languages for some reason. So actually, what the idea is that let's try to encode the structure as a string of bits. So this is actually, you're probably going to look at the slides later, but so this is to demonstrate to you that you can encode any binary tree, in fact, into the string of bits with the cost of at most 2 bits per item, and then decode them with a very simple state machine, as I provide here. So the decoding allows you to either rebuild the whole tree or actually compute Merkle hash efficiently. And then what you do next is that you have this huge tree, which is balanced, and you would merkleize it according to this huge tree. And then in order to efficiently store it in the database, you split it into pages of the fixed size. And this is kind of the schematics of how you would do it. Then after you do that, you encode them in the pages. And this is the structure of the page I'm using in proof of concept. It's got like different elements in that. And what is interesting here is the page pointer. So there's two elements stored in the pages, that the values, you can see that FP there. And this is the circle with the arrows are the pointers. And so then after that, you can actually add the history. So let's talk about this. So first of all, in order to explain more in a short sentence, is that the main idea is that you use the same structure for the database index as the structure that you use for merkleization. So it's the same. So that means that whenever you actually commit something into the database, it doesn't move anymore, because it's in exactly the same in exactly the place where it's supposed to be, according to the index of the database, which means that write amplification equals basically write amplification does not happen, and so the database just grows. It doesn't keep rewriting things on a disk. It just simply adds things, which has some nice properties. So at the moment, with my proof of concept, which I've been running, I was comparing with Turbogeth, which is also quite already high bar. So the write efficiency has been about 7 times better than in Turbogeth. So it means that it actually has set 7 times less I/O. Unfortunately, the space efficiency has decreased compared to Turbogeth. It's about 4 times less space efficient in the current numbers. But I have I know some ways how you can improve that. Access efficiency, I only superficially tested that. So to put it in perspective is that people usually talk about the trade-off of 3 things in databases: update efficiency, space efficiency, and access efficiency. And you can see that you really want to be inside this triangle, not plane, but you never really know whether you're above that triangle, which means that you don't actually have an efficient trade-off, optimal trade-off, or you're in a triangle. So what I'm trying to do is that I posit that non-optimized systems are already above the triangle, so they're not really exercising trade-offs at all. So they're inefficient in any way, in any possible way. But what I'm trying to do now is hopefully I am inside the triangle already and trying to navigating between them. So I'm gonna, if it's any time, I'm gonna take any questions. Any time for questions or?
Yes. Yeah. There's some time for questions.
Yeah, I rushed
it. I'll run the mic to you if you have any questions.
Yeah.
So just that I understand it, this 200 gigabytes or 200 plus 70 for the receipts, that's actually an archive node, right?
Yeah, it's an archive node.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, and it can fetch you any data for the entire history through any RPC queries.
Can you talk more about this range request?
Range request. It's basically so range request is quite simple, because essentially you are in most of these key value stores. What you can do, you can open the cursor at a certain. You can seek to the certain key. For example, in this case, it will be one with some 0000, whatever the first key is to start with one, and then you just use that iterator to iterate through them until you see 2 in the first position. That's a range query. It's not like SQL, but it's still possible efficiently.
Alexei, can you talk a little bit more about your experiment with Ethermint and why it was
Yes,
slow?
I forgot about that, sorry. Yeah. So the Ethermint experiment is interesting for me because at the moment when I only try to optimize the Turbogeth, and there is a Patricia tree, which I already I said that I don't like it very much, but and it's encoded in the yellow paper. But what I want to kind of look beyond the yellow paper, maybe because it's cool, because I want to search for different structures, maybe because they're going to be used in ETH 2.0, because we might be able to create something more efficient in Ethermint, and then we could just transplant this into the Ethereum. It's probably good for experimentation. I also quite like working with the Ethermint team, so yeah, it's that's the reason.
But
We probably have any, one more question.
Was there any like performance difference when you were doing Ethermint versus...
Ethermint is on very early stages, and the whole reason why I started to do this Morris thing is because the first performance tests were not satisfactory to me. So I wanted that to be faster.
We probably have time for one more question. Yeah.
First of all, I just wanted to ask, do you realize how amazing you are?
Oh, thank you. Flattering.
And then secondly, can you just go in a little bit more detail of how you come from 1.3 terabytes to 250 gigabytes with the same, it feels like the same performance, but a very significant decrease in the size. How exactly did that?
Well, comes from two things. First of all, I don't store any hashes, and the hashes are probably one of the biggest contributors to the space in existing clients. And secondly, the tree structure, when you model the history as a tree structure, it repeats a lot of the elements on closer to the root when you create a new version. So that repetition also, that it also contributes to the Morris being less space efficient because it's also tree-based. So, that's basically two reasons. And if you remove these two things, that becomes super space efficient.
All right, well, thank you very much, Alexei.
Thank you for
coming. It's been great.